And good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. Coming up shortly, Dan Persons reviews Rogue One, and then Terrence Taylor and I are off spinning tales. Stay tuned. Thank you.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. Is Gareth Edwards the one who will bring balance to the force? Or maybe just the film industry as it has currently evolved or devolved, depending on your point of view. The British director started out in special effects before ascending to directorship on two notable films. Monsters, about two Americans trying to get across the Mexican border in a world infested by a rapidly spreading alien life form. And Godzilla, the second and considerably more successful attempt to westernize the king of all kaiju. In both those cases, it was clear Edwards was dancing to a different cinematic beat, more thoughtful, and despite the large palettes and giant monsters he was dealing with in both films, more intimate, more grounded. Monsters, in which Edwards actually filmed semi-documentary, semi-improvised footage with his actors engaging with real people, didn't work quite as well as it could have. Godzilla raised controversy for not being wall-to-wall monster stomping, even though that honored the narrative traditions of Asian kaiju, and even with that, Edwards followed his own muse, creating something that nodded to both Japanese monster movies and Western blockbusters without feeling like a clone of either. Now Edwards has delivered Rogue One, a Star Wars story, a prequel that tells the tale of how a ragtag band of rebels, led by Felicity Jones and Diego Luna and aided and abetted by the dizzying likes of Donnie Yen, Alan Tudyk, Wen Zhang, Mads Mikkelsen, Forrest Whitaker, and on, stole the plans to the Death Star that Princess Leia would eventually deliver to Obi-Wan Kenobi in the original Star Wars, otherwise known as A New Hope. And make no mistake, if you're looking for all the Star Wars stuff, it is here. Big space battles, strange creatures, all the Rebels versus Empire stuff, Darth Vader, and blue milk. But it doesn't feel like a Star Wars film, although it's no less satisfying or fun for that. And I'm trying to figure out what Edwards has done that it is this way. I keep landing on words like asymmetrical and syncopated to account for the director's way with the narrative. It's clear his rhythms are not those of a conventional blockbuster filmmaker. Maybe too much so. It's well known that reshoots were ordered, although whatever those were certainly didn't hurt the final result any. In any case, whatever he was doing resulted in me being totally absorbed in the film and feeling like I really didn't know the direction the film would take. And after 40 years of Star Wars, holy Jesus bleep, has it really been that long? This is a welcome kick in the butt for the science fantasy franchise. Here's what I'm wondering. George Lucas, willingly or not, single-handedly rewrote the world of mainstream filmmaking with Star Wars. As has frequently been noted, the industry has since become the domain of big-budget B-movies. That's not necessarily a bad thing. There have been some great films done in the field, along with, admittedly, a lot of crap. But we learned to expect this kind of storytelling in our movies, a certain kind of pace, a certain kind of attitude. Edwards, having been given an obvious one-off with Rogue One that allowed him to follow his muse, subtly subverts that. It's everything you're expecting, but not really. And could this be the start of the deprogramming of the film-going public? Rogue One, by its very nature as a Star Wars film, is going to bring in the crowds, and they won't be disappointed. What they'll see is the space fantasy they've come to expect and want. But they'll also, without realizing it, be exposed to a different kind of rhythm, a different outlook. It's possible, not really likely, but possible, that this could open them to new forms of storytelling, more nuanced, more mature. Or we could just go back to the typical boom-boom stuff we've been working with for decades. That's not impossible either. But for now, Rogue One, a Star Wars story, is a daring breakaway from what we've come to expect from the franchise. In fact, I think it's the best Star Wars film made yet. Yes, even including A New Hope, and one of the best films this year. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons.
Okay, well, thank you, Dan. I'm trying to deal with technical issues here, and no. I don't think I need to deal with that part of it at any rate. So, we are going to talk largely not just cinema, but entertainment this morning. Pardon me, I have been throwing the show together in like the last 2 to 3 hours. It's been a hellacious couple of weeks for me, part of which is actually, you know, for the most part, good. Some of it not so good, with winter illnesses coming on and stuff like that. But also with a very successful New York Review of Science Fiction reading, with Delia Sherman and Ellen Kushner, our annual, and a private affair that I help throw every year, and which takes quite a bit out of me, and delivering 2 audiobooks late, and 10 podcasts for the month, 2 of which I successfully palmed off, and 1 of which turned out to be the person, one of the 2 wonderful people that were reading at the KGB Fantastic Fiction reading series tonight. In fact, had I the information and a TARDIS in front of me, I would tell you, you know, go back to see Livia Llewellyn and Sarah Pinsker, 2 favorites, 2 absolute favorites at the KGB reading that occurred earlier this evening. And I will be getting the recording, thanks to Gordon Linzer. I will be hearing it. But via phone, sounds like an old movie studio, right? Warner Brothers movie studio. We're going to talk with Terrence Taylor, who is also involved in the reading series, although transitioning from technical director to actually being the technical director instead of the technical do-it-all. Let me see now if using Skype, I'm using Skype to phone. Now, what the heck? Why is it asking me to choose country or region? It has the area code. It's the same area code that we're in. Hell, it's practically the same zip code. Okay, yes, now it knows. Will you dial now? Ah, yes. It's doing its little Skypey noises. And da-da-da, da-da-da. And there, his phone is ringing.
Hello?
Hi there, you're on the air.
I'm on my computer, so I'm not hearing you talking in the past in my other ear.
There you go. Okay, so we're on the air. I'm calling you via Skype.
Ah, the magic of the modern age.
Yeah, I wasn't sure. I sent you a text asking if you were on Skype, but then we're not connected on Skype, and one has to do the whole handshake before you can Skype to Skype, I think. I don't use Skype that much. The sound quality isn't much better, Skype to phone.
Yeah.
Do you Skype? Have you Skype handy?
I am. Could I put up my blue microphone and talk via Skype rather than by phone?
Yeah, it would be better sound quality, I think. Although then, immediately look me up and I guess try to Skype me.
Okay. Let's see.
I heard that
technology as we speak. I'm like going in. Let's see. Let's find the Skype.
Yeah, it says I'm online. But when I looked you up as contact, you weren't there.
I don't think we've ever Skyped, so.
Yeah, I do it very rarely. Let's see. I can search the Skype directory. Let me see if I can find you there.
Psychochondriac is my
Skype-ochondriac?
Okay. Like hypochondriac only mentally.
Oh, my. There are so many Terrence Taylors on Skype. I can see why you use...
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and none of them are in New York, amazingly. So how do you spell that? Spell that for me.
Psycho, like the movie.
Oh, okay.
And then chondriac, like hypochondriac.
Okay, got it.
D-R-I-A.
Psychochondriac.
Right now I'm trying to get signed in so I can actually...
No, I must be spelling some of the psychocon. Oh, there's an H in con, isn't there? Just like in, as in Wrath of... Oh, I found you. Good.
Successfully put myself online. Now I have to...
But you're not in my contacts. Okay, add to contacts.
Well, no.
And never... then I have to send you a contact request, which I just did.
Okay.
Tells me about all these people I... don't know being online.
Put on my headphones, otherwise when I talk to you... Okay, hang on, where's my...
I'm sorry, listeners.
Oh, it's fascinating. They're getting to hear modern communications in action.
Yeah, right.
Okay, I'm not seeing the invite. Oh, wait. No, here's...
No, it says add to group call.
Well, see, it's odd because I do have you here under family and friends, actually.
Okay. So
if I hit the telephone, will I get through to you?
Maybe so. Okay, yes. Nothing is true. Ready? Answering this call, put your... Okay, that should be all right.
Yep, that's me. Okay.
Yeah. Oh, much better.
There we go. Okay.
Oh, my God. The sound quality is so different.
Oh, dear. Okay, hang on. I have to turn on headphones so I can hear you now.
My God, what a difference.
Oh, well, that's a good thing. This is good to know.
No, I mean, it is so bleeping different.
There we go. Okay, I'm going to pull... So I can hang up the phone
You
now.
Can hang up the phone now.
Okay, there we go.
Okay.
Okay. Oh, well, you're much clearer in my head as well.
I hope so. There we go.
Yes, and I now have the microphone actually in front of my mouth instead of over to the side of the desk.
Okay, so let's introduce you to listeners who are hearing this for the very first time.
Now that we can be heard.
Yes, exactly.
Wow, you may never get me in studio again if it sounds like I'm actually there now.
it approaches acceptable, especially considering the state of the studio.
Very good. Very good. Okay, I can kill the web link now because I can't listen to that anyway.
Yeah.
There we go. So, it's been a year. Yes, I also am staggering into the end of the year on the verge of exhaustion. And just so the universe and everyone knows, neither of us are complaining.
I've been
given a great deal of work that gave us money, and we're happy for that. But at the same time, one likes to be able to live to spend it. So it's like...
Yeah, exactly. I also got sick through...
Yeah.
I have a deadline, had another deadline come at me sort of out of left field. And there's a reading tomorrow that one must attend because all kinds of friends of both you and I are doing it.
I have evidently not been paying attention to my media enough to know that it's happening. What reading would this be?
It's at a gaming store in Brooklyn called something like 20 Sides, you know, referring to the number of dice.
Ah.
And it's Rob Cameron and... Barbara Krasnoff and Carlos Hernandez and C.S.E. Cooney.
Oh, my. Wow.
Yeah, that's quite a reading. And somebody else whose name is escaping me. And maybe, I would also like to be able to, just fire up, because I'm tight, just fire up a browser and look it up, only, of course... I'm using the Win 10 machine here.
Well, yes, but I, on the other hand, am sitting in front of my Mac monitor. Okay, so what would I Google to find out information on this?
I don't know. How about today's date, because it's later today.
It's Thursday.
Yeah, 12:22 reading. See, I'm not even sure of the name of the place, but we know it's Carlos. We don't know what name Rob is using, because that's a regular ongoing thing.
Wait, though, what was the name of the gaming place?
I just said I don't know, I don't remember. It's something like 20 Sides, but I'm not sure about that, not being a gamer.
Let's see.
Okay, let's see. No, great. It gave me a ReaderCon program. Because it's all the same people.
Let's see.
You know, something like the word sides is in there, I know, as in sides of dice.
My goodness, there's a lot of...
got it. The 20-sided store.
Mentions of
I found Barbara Krasnoff's blog. Okay. Yes, Chris Kreuter. Chris Kreuter is the other person. I think he's the person putting it together. C-R-E-U-T-E-R. I'm assuming it's pronounced Kreuter, because EU in German, like Freund, Kreuter, I'm guessing. So this is at 7 p.m. at 362 Grand Street in Brooklyn. And the readers, again, are Chris Kreuter, Carlos Hernandez, C.S.E. Cooney, Rob Cameron, and Barbara Krasnoff.
I must be looking at the wrong thing. I'm still not finding it.
Well, if you go to brooklynwriter.com, which is Barbara Krasnoff's website, you will see it there.
Here we are. Okay, there we go. Ah, here we are. Very good. Okay, cool.
And unfortunately, I don't see a... Oh, wait, no, there is a link to the 20-sided store. And, yeah, it's not... Okay, and I guess if one clicks under events...
I don't think they're quite as updated as they need to be, because I don't see...
It's not listed, right?
No, I'm sure quite a great deal not listed, so yes. But nonetheless, it does give where they are, and from that one can figure out how to get there.
Yeah, but it's 20sidedstore.com for listeners to look up. And then, of course, in January... begins our first reading for the year, the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. We're avoiding the first Tuesday of the month because it's like, you know, 2 days after New Year's. So we're going to be on the second Tuesday of the month, whatever date that is. Let me take a look. That would be the 10th. And that will be... Okay, do you want to say the... person's name? Fenderson Blank Clark.
It is not in front of me.
Dejeli.
Yes.
Or Dejeli. Or Gili.
I understand that Lee is what is accented.
So yeah.
Dejeli.
Yeah, Dejeli. That sounds right.
He can correct us. He can actually finally tell us.
Yeah, except he'll get it wrong on purpose. And... Shan Chakrabarti, or Shan. You see, I get her name wrong. It's Shan Chakrabarti. She has Near Eastern or Far Eastern last name, but her first name is Irish. Shan is short for Shannon.
Ah.
And the curator for that event will be Rob Cameron, which means that Cam Rob will not be Terrence Taylor.
Yes, well, we'll...
That is to say, the videographer of the event.
We'll have to see if I can do it or if we break Stephen back in again.
Well, how about me?
Or you. I'm desperate to make you do that.
Yes, no, yeah, so am I, yeah.
It's very odd. I cannot find the actual... address of this place on their website. I don't quite understand why it's so...
Well, it was on Barbara's blog, and she has...
Yes, thank God, because it's not on their website at all.
So it's 362 Grand Street at 7 p.m. later today, which is to say much later today. as in, 29 hours from now or something like that. Not 29 hours.
I was going to say
19 hours.
Going to push you a little bit too far.
Yeah. If you go in there 29 hours from now, it'll be even chillier.
Well, yes.
Yeah. So at any rate, all that aside, did you, I take it you have not yet seen Rogue One.
I have not. I keep hearing, I mean, the Times was wantonly unenthusiastic.
Well, that, okay, let's be more specific.
I'm not done talking, but I keep hearing what I heard in the review from other people, which is that they loved it and they thought it was really great and everything.
Yeah, what I was going to point out is you will never find a movie of this sort that that Tony Scott loves in the Times. Had it been Manola Dargis reviewing it, you might have gotten a different reception. But he seriously dislikes superhero movies and films of this nature, with rare exceptions.
Why do they have him reviewing them then?
Because
contrary opinions.
So because there are 50 talking movies and two reviewers.
Well, you'd think they'd divvy them up better. Although she'd only give good reviews to everything.
No, she doesn't actually. She doesn't.
I'll be curious to see their review of Passengers.
Well, I mean, the reviews are out. It has opened.
I thought it was opening tomorrow.
I think it opened by virtue of the fact that it was at a film festival. But
well, that's.
I've seen 10 reviews. Not one of them was positive.
Well, that would be justifiable, in my opinion. It's beautifully. Shall we talk about it?
I mean, I can go right give your review. Go right ahead.
Yes, it's a review. Oh my! There's a little window on my screen that, would, if I clicked on it, would disconnect the Skype call. I wasn't careful with that.
Okay.
I was looking at that, going, "What is that little thing?"
Close that window.
In.
Yes.
I shan't. I've got the Times in front of me, which I might want to take away. I was reflexively clicking in to see if they had the review of Passengers. I went to a Writers Guild screening. It's lovely being a member of the Writers Guild. This is review, not review, voting season. So they finally sent me some screeners, but I've been attending some screenings. And
we need to explain to people what screeners are. They're
screeners
DVDs
are
or links.
DVD copies of movies with little text at the bottom saying, "Dear God, you've been given this through special circumstance. If you give it to anyone else and we find a bootleg, we're going to come to your door and beat your house down." So I'm always very careful with them. You're supposed to either destroy them after viewing or seal them in a vault or something like that. So I vault them because in my old age, I may want to rewatch all these movies. But it allows one to catch up on a large number of movies that one might not ordinarily wish to go out and see and pay money to all in a row. It gives you a nice representation of what's actually happening in the industry. So I have Arrival, which I'm very interested to watch.
Arrival very, very much tops. There are four movies that I want to see before the year ends, and that time is going away quickly.
Well, you know, I'll be having a little screening party with movies, so you could come over here with Barbara and watch it. Then when you get to my list of movie screeners, that's on it. At any rate, Passengers, there were several. First of all, anyone who wants to see it and doesn't want to be highly annoyed with me should stop listening momentarily.
Yeah, but this will not be spoiler-free. We won't necessarily give away the end.
No, though it's also inevitable. I mean, that's the major problem. The movie relies. I was thinking about it before you called me back, and I was thinking that the best way to describe its flaws is that it plays very much like a Hollywood pitch for a movie of its type. And it commits to its arc, and it pushes through to the end despite any logic or reason or character that might make it do anything different. And that's the major problem with it. It's a remarkably predictable film. It relies on a lengthy series of astonishing coincidences, not the least of which to me is the most and here's where we enter spoiler territory. The ship hits a meteor storm. It is damaged.
Okay. And it's not a normal ship. It's a not a multi-generational.
No, it's not multi-generational. It's actually the entire crew and cast are in deep freeze. They're taking a 100-year journey to a colony in a distant galaxy far, far away. I imagine they'll wake up and find Luke Skywalker standing over them wondering what they're doing there. But at any rate, the idea is that this company has sent out a colonization ship in the past. It was enormously successful. They make a gajillion dollars or some similar number that they isn't made up, but it's like whatever's beyond trillions. They've just made an insane amount of money. So they're sending out another ship and to Homestead 2. And despite all of its little precautions, it then proceeds to sustain damage. It then triggers a cascade of failures throughout the ship, the result of which is that Chris Pratt's character is awakened in his hibernation chamber, which is not supposed to wake him up for another 90 years. It wakes him up as if it's 4 months before the end of the voyage, which evidently was supposed to be spent by the assorted passengers just living it up like they're on a luxury liner for 4 months as they await their arrival at their new home, at which point they will be hopelessly in debt to the company that's gotten them there and spend the rest of their existence and undoubtedly multi-generations into the future paying off that bill. Despite that, the ship, though there are 5,000 passengers and 250-odd crew members, has opted to randomly wake up a guy who is a mechanic. And there's a word before mechanic. It's not auto. But at any rate, as he discusses later with the young woman who he meets, he likes to work with his hands, which makes him different from her because she's a writer. She likes to work with her mind. Her entire purpose of this journey is a mental exercise where she's going to – her father was a Pulitzer Prize winner.
And one has to avoid making comments that he likes to work with his hands, so he wakes up Jennifer Lawrence.
Well, I didn't say it. You can take those letters. And
I was quoting somebody fictional.
At any rate, she is a charming companion until, of course, she finds out that he woke her up. Because, of course, he spends a year and a half running around the ship trying to get back into deep freeze. Can't. Out of all the people, for whatever reason, he pretty much fixates on the first one he looks at a bio of. I can't remember the process by which he finds her particular pod, but he finds her charming.
He I'm looks sorry. At her little, I was going to say he found her picture on iCloud.
Well, there you go. You know, he went to Facebook. He read a few entries. He found someone he thought he'd match with. It was undoubtedly an OKCupid matchup.
That's a terrible thing to say, I know, but given that the film is really marketing itself based on the attraction of its two lead characters.
Well, and they're both quite attractive.
And they're both good actors.
They're both good actors. And I don't fault them at all. I mean, even Lawrence Fishburne in his three-day shoot role does a lovely turn and goes through a series of increasingly sickly makeup, which pretty much cues us that he's not going to be in the movie very long. So the main problem I have with the initial awakening is that there is no real ever established apparent reason that the first person, the only person to accidentally be awakened by the ship, is an engineer who can figure out how to open other pods and ultimately figure out how to resolve the problems plaguing the ship that then saves it and its entire contingent of passengers and crew. Had the ship woken an engineer on purpose, had it looked at its manifest and said, here is the most likely person to achieve this, that would have made it a much more logical movie. But it begins there and it doesn't stop. Every step of the way, it's just what has to happen for the movie to continue. And there's a moment where to establish that he has justification in waking up someone and ruining their life as his has been ruined, because he's going to die before they ever get to before anyone else is even awakened. And I have to agree that spending 90 years alone in a ship like that is not, I don't care how, and he can only get like, you know, deck level. Yeah,
may I point out, by the way, how old a trope that is in science fiction.
It's an ancient trope. And the thing is that they bring nothing new to it. Ultimately, of course, you know, the android that he swears to secrecy, asking not to tell her that he woke her up, tells her just as he goes. They have a date. They're establishing a real romance. He's about to give her a ring to seal it, because if you want to keep it, you got to put a ring on it, evidently, even several hundred years in the future, even though there's no competition.
You are literally
the only man in the world.
That goes all the way to the distant, distant past, before the church took over marriages. Rings were a form of bonding. You shared a ring, you made a vow, and you were wed. No witnesses necessary.
I think the initial rings were probably around necks with chains attached to them, and they evolved down to one on the finger because it got a little unwieldy. It's you know, terribly proprietary. Oh, I'm getting an odd hiss in the background, a room Tony thing that I didn't get before. Well, the connection is still good. But at any rate, the bottom line is it goes through the inevitable rom-com arc, which is, of course, she finds out, she's furious, you've ruined my life. They go through this for several days while she's doing her best to avoid him on a pretty large ship, so it's not really that hard until he starts pleading with her across the broadcast loudspeaker system of the ship. At any rate, they stumble across Lawrence Fishburne, who's been awakened from the crew because the ship is still malfunctioning. He gives them all the clues they need to figure out what's actually going on. They begin to find resolution, but again, he's been woken up badly. So even though he's been awakened by the exact same malfunctions that awakened the first character, he's falling apart, as 500 odd disorders, and he dies in quick succession after giving them a bracelet, which gives them the authority to control the ship, more or less, and override its, you know, auto reply. There is a musing sequence where he's trying to get back to sleep, and he's going through the ship, and he's talking to the robot, the android, and he's doing all these things trying to get solutions and answers, and he's having the same luck one has from a flowcharted recorded voice on a phone. And my feeling is several things. One, that a ship that sophisticated would kind of have an AI that could respond better than Autobot responses. And B, that you don't send people off on a 100-year voyage in a ship you're declaring to be foolproof, as the Titanic was declared to be, without some sort of backup system in place. If the ship gets hit through the meteor storm, members of the crew should be awakened who can then repair it, fix everything, and then go back into hibernation. Why would you not do that with a project this expensive and with that much writing on it? Why is it that it takes the entire film to figure out that, oh, the auto doc that saves his life after he fixes the ship, goes into space, and is nearly lost till she goes out to rescue him, cementing their passion for each other. And he discovers after reading even more manuals, because a lot of this is really – the real lesson of Passengers – read the manual. You know, you don't just go in and start doing stuff. Read the manual. It's going to tell you a lot.
Yeah, so the sequel is going to be called Passengers RTFM.
Which would be Friendly
Manual.
I figured it out really quickly. Yes, well, the thing is that they then have their romantic reunion, at which point he says, look, while you weren't speaking to me, I guess, is the only time he had available after she was awakened. He discovered that the auto dock machine, which is remarkably similar to the auto dock machine in what was the last Ridley Scott thing about the Alien prequel? You know, they all pretty much look the same. A nice big glass case that slides open. You get inside and it tells you what's wrong with you. He figures out that it could actually has a hibernation mode, so he could actually put her back to sleep for the next 90 years and give her back her dream. But of course, it being Chris Pratt, after 6 months with a trainer, rather than do that, she's like, but I'll never see you again, and those firm pecs and those tight buttocks. So she decides to stay with him, and that's the thing. This leads up to what is the funniest thing of the film. Not intended to be, but in the posters and all the ads, you see that Andy Garcia is in the film. At the point that she decides she's going to stay awake and stay with him, and they're going to make a life together, we then go to a pan through the ship where her voiceover is greeting the waking passengers at the end of their journey and basically telling them that if they're awake now, this is their story. They were awake the entire time they were asleep. If your bed looks like it's been screwed in, it's because we screwed in it. We had 90 years and we screwed in every bed in this ship. So you see the door open. You see Andy Garcia in his uniform and this crew behind him step through the door and look about them in amazement. And you then cut to see that the lobby has been terraformed and it's covered in lawn and trees and it's a tropical paradise, because if you're living in a fantastic luxury ship and she's got gold card, she gets them good meals. He only could get oatmeal. She can get the good stuff. But they opted to live in a desert island that they make out of this high-tech spaceship in space. It's all very amusing. And that's it. That's it. Andy Garcia is one shot in this movie. And I understand that they hired him for 3 days. He had a whole lot of other stuff he shot. And that they decided they really didn't need it, in which case that decision could have been made before the script was done.
Well, that's called
shooting, and before they hired a fairly major star who's won a number of awards to say more than he doesn't even have a line. He doesn't even get to go, what the
two,
hell?
Two nothing. Words, DVD extra.
Well, I can only imagine, but they're going to be boring, stupid scenes that are pointless. It's going to be the crew waking up, looking at their controls, going, what's this? What's going on in Deck B? There seems to be a lot of heat and plant life. And then they go down and see what it is. But, I mean, all of which is losable, all of which doesn't need to exist in the script. I always find it amazing.
In brief, don't see it.
No. Well, the thing I – but, well
– there's so much interesting stuff out there.
Don't pay a lot of money and take a great deal of effort to see it. There is a point at 2 a.m. when one is under the influence of assorted intoxicants and simply needs something visual and pretty on a big HD screen to entertain one until one passes out completely. It's perfectly suitable for that purpose. As a soporific before sleep, I imagine that nothing could put you to sleep faster than Passengers. But
there is the tagline for the movie.
There you go. So I mean,
a great soporific.
Shot. Yeah, I mean, the thing is, it's beautifully shot. I mean, it's
and most
gorgeous
people don't even know what
design.
The word means.
The ship's amazing. I mean, I love the ship. It has a DNA sort of theme. Because they did it. They did the rotating gravity. We've got a rotating ship around a core that produces its own artificial gravity by not technically actually centrifugal force, as it turns out, by some other means, but rather than simply being a ring in rotation, it's sort of strips that wrap around rather like DNA strands. So there's some beautiful design work in it. There's lovely effects. The performances are very good. Pratt and Jennifer Lawrence are delightful. Lawrence's performance, you know, reeks a little at times of Silver Lining Playbook. I mean, the same sort of angry, oh, you stupid man stuff. You know, it's not. For the $20 million she got, she could have worked a little harder, you know, and making something a little more original.
Oh, well, I have a feeling that this was thrown together.
He certainly gave them their $12 million.
Yeah. It was probably, I could be wrong. It's just the impression I have from the way that this movie came out of nowhere with little advance marketing and dropped into the season. Yeah, that's
never a good sign. When
yeah, exactly.
Five casts have been gone.
But
through.
But going past to original stories, more original stories, I should say. The oldest one I can think of, I think it may have been Fred Pohl, more likely Robert Sheckley. It's very much his kind of story. Is somebody's on a ship. It's either it's a deep freeze ship like this, and they go and there's this big ceremony, and Earth, all of Earth, sends them off. And when they get there, they arrive at this gorgeous, fully populated planet, which is in its umpteenth generation.
Oh, because after they left, they came up with a fast, instant way of getting there.
Exactly, because right after they left, the faster-than-light drive was invented, and there was no way to actually, stop their ship and say, come with us.
Well, see, and I would question that. I'm thinking, really? You can't figure out where it is mathematically based on everything that we know and just fly to that place, you know, slowly go on under impulse power, link to the – I mean, come on. They could have if they wanted to. They were just dicking with them.
Well, what I'm naming is a story from the late 40s, early 50s probably.
When they didn't even know how starships would work, much less – and it's a device. You say they can't do it because that makes the story. But see, again, organically, I mean, there's no logic to
that.
Going back to Passengers, so here's the thing. So the whole ending is...
I was going to name the other stories. I'm really very much done with Passengers, but go
on. No, I just had to wrap up one stupid thing, though. So at the end, when he comes up with this whole auto-doc thing, there's one of these things, you can sleep, I can give you back your life. The first question in my mind is like, seriously? You have 5,000 passengers and over 250 crew members. You didn't wake these guys up that well. I'm thinking that the first 1,000 people are going to not want to wait online for the auto dock when they can't poop. It's so ludicrous that there would be one auto dock on the entire ship for that many people.
Yeah, that's pretty bizarre.
There should have been at least 5, and they could easily have gone back to sleep and woken up at the other end after paying for the damage they did to the deck when he was ripping up the floor and putting in a tree.
Yeah.
So now I'm done with Passengers.
Okay, but yeah, I had another story or two to mention that deals with the same theme and... Pardon me, just so much better, so much better. This really sounds like a hack job.
Well, it is, and I just find that, I find it amazing. Well,
there are a lot of graphically pleasing movies that are hack jobs, and some of them that are pseudo hack jobs.
Well, the thing is that I don't use the term hack job. You don't spend a quarter billion dollars on a hack job. You spend it on a bad script.
Oh, yes, you do. One word, Transformers.
Well, yes, but I'm sorry, but it's technically, it's a proficiently well-made film. It's just a terrible script. None of these movies are hack jobs. They are highly engineered pieces of equipment that work precisely as intended. The problem is the intent. And the problem is that they start with a script that is flawed. It is based on certain formula that they consider to be successful, because at the point you're spending the GMP of a small nation for a movie to make the movie, not even to promote the movie, because that's a whole other $250 million. You need to make several billion dollars to make that profitable. At that point, no risks are involved. No one is doing anything based on their own thought. They're going into, like, you know, algorithms to figure out plot. But the problem is, what you get is computerized, dull, little predictable plots that aren't at all entertaining. And the things that spend less money and take greater risks. I mean, the reason the Blair Witch Project was so big at the time was that they spent so little money and made so much back. And it's the same thing, reason the Halloween was successful. Hollywood's basic premise of success is, how little can we put in and how much can we get back? Well, they no longer have the imagination to make little priced things.
Well, the entire industry has changed, because now it's not how much money did your movie make over a period of time, it's how much did it make opening weekend.
No, but that's exactly it. And the problem is that, yeah, when you make movies that have to make their money back in the opening weekend, because after that everyone knows they're really bad.
No, that's not it. What it is is how much money they make the opening weekend is going to determine and help manipulate the stock value of the distributing and releasing film. It's all about the stock market.
Which is why, you know, basically Hamilton should have been shot by Burr much earlier, before he established Wall Street. You know, it's affects everything in a negative way. I've yet to see any real benefit to what it does. I'm very unhappy with the way our economy works at this point, because it's flawed.
Well, that's something that's only happened in the last 15, 20 years. It didn't used to be that way.
Yeah, really.
But, you know, a good example is how people talk about how terrible a movie John Carter is. Now, first of all,
John Carter is not a bad movie.
No, it's not a bad movie at all.
But it didn't make money.
It did make money. It made a lot of money.
It didn't get the opening weekend.
It didn't make money in the opening weekend.
Right. And that's a bad judgment for a good or bad movie. I mean, there's a lot of movies that, but I don't really care.
Let me tell the story, may I? There was a lot more to it than just that. It was that somebody at the releasing company, the inner politics of that company, decided that they wanted John Carter to not succeed.
It had to do with politics of getting someone who okayed it out, wasn't it? I mean,
that's exactly it. And companies within companies. When I first heard about John Carter, the rumors were, I don't know if this is true, that this was to be the first live action Pixar film, which was understandable because the director was Andrew Stanton, who had done one of my favorite science fiction movies, WALL-E. and talking about big ships waiting to reach their destinations, and they used a lot of the Pixar technologies and extending them and reinventing them and all that to make what looks like a fairly flawless Martian-based Skiffy movie. And so somewhere, somehow, yes, there were all kinds of scapegoats on that. Ultimately, it was determined, let's write this movie off. By the time these things hit the DVD market, the Netflix market, the streaming market, and most importantly of all, the Asian market.
I was going to say China. Well, but the thing is, though, none of these things actually...
Actually, in this case, Japan.
None of these things actually lose money.
They never
make their
do.
Money. But the thing is that the concept of what is successful or not is very skewed. And
now, I take that back. There are a few movies that spend so much outrageous money and were so bad to begin with that they do actually lose money.
Did Green Lantern lose money, I wonder? I don't know. That was pretty dreadful.
You know, I didn't... once again, I didn't hate Green Lantern. I saw it as a comedy... It was a goof. It's sort of the other side of where the DC films are now.
I was going to say, okay, if you try to compare it to Deadpool in any way or form because of Ryan Reynolds and...
No, I'm talking about... No, the DC universe today isn't even... first of all, it's not the X-Men universe, which Deadpool is a part of it. It's the Superman, Justice League of America, Wonder Woman, Batman universe. The Zack Snyder universe that to me reeks so horribly. Deadpool, you know, I could I liked part of what they were doing, but I have to say the pleasure of it wore out half an hour in until Leslie Gore came on screen. And then I enjoyed
it. Yes, but you're not a blood fiend like I am. I mean, I love Deadpool, like, because I'm a very big fan of the comics, and I had been introduced to them by a reader at ReaderCon a couple of years ago. I was talking to her afterwards, and Deadpool came up, and she started rattling off a description and talking about the blind woman he lives with, who's his best friend, who he kills anyone she tries to make friends with. And I'm looking at her like, what are you talking about? And then I started reading it on the Marvel app, and I just loved it. Deadpool, to me, is Marvel's Lobo. Lobo is a DC character that is an assassin, hitman, morally reprehensible, horrible, 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 horrible person. One of the best characters they've ever done.
Yeah, but Deadpool, again, is a Marvel character, and I was talking about the DC universe.
Right, what?
I was making reference before to the DC universe.
Yeah, no, I know.
Deadpool is the Marvel universe.
Yes, that's why I brought up Lobo, who's in the DC universe.
Oh, I see, okay. But
DC I find it very interesting. Now
there were four movies I wanted to discuss, and Passengers was not one of them.
Well, we're done with that one. What were the others you wanted to discuss?
These are movies that other people have covered. It's just that I have been so busy, and the same for you, which is a good thing because both you and I spent most of the year with no paying work, and then all of a sudden, November, December.
As part of the year,
yeah. All of a sudden there was stuff that you're nearly done with, and I'm getting there. I can see the finish line. But at any rate, the films that I want to see big screen, and I've got two events that I will choose. One will be Christmas Day, three events, Christmas Day, my birthday, and New Year's. And so the films are Arrival, because, of course, you know, speaking of ReaderCon, I see Ted Chiang there every year.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
I'm a
very
big
good for Ted.
I'm a big, big fan of his writing. I've never had the opportunity to interview him at length. I hope that will change. But he's also a hero to me in that he's one of the few people who has managed to write nothing but short stories, no novels, and has made it big time. Usually when you're a short story writer and a highly gifted short story writer, let's say somebody like Ken Liu, the agents and publishers will say, okay, we will put out a collection of your stories as soon as you promise us at least a novel, if not a trilogy, if not a franchise. And Ted somehow has managed to win and Ken wins every award there is. And Ted manages to do that as well. But here is somebody, a serious science fiction writer who's taken on by a serious filmmaker whose time has come. He hath arrived in Arrival. So I'm very much looking.
Sorry, that's very tagline-y.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? And I'm just on the fly. The other reason I'm so interested in Arrival is I see it as part of a trilogy of films. And those films are, it all begins with 2001, A Space Odyssey, which is Kubrick's very, very typical of Kubrick, and I'm a huge, huge Kubrick fan, but he is described as a cold director. His view of the universe, of humanity, of everything is very cold, very alien. And I think that's very true. Look at Clockwork Orange, for an example, or Full Metal Jacket. Andrei Tarkovsky, the Russian director, took a look at 2001, and he made a movie that was, to him, the antithesis of 2001, and that's Solaris, based on the novel by Stanislav Lem. And his story is very hot. It is all about humanity, about people, how they cope with each other, how they deal with each other. There's none of that in 2001. There's no room for that. So he actually takes very similar themes, including, again, most importantly, the unknowable alien, not the alien that we will figure out, but the alien who is, by nature of the fact that they are alien, that they will never, ever know. And that's his version of Solaris. Steven Soderbergh's version of Solaris isn't bad either. It's not as good. Tarkovsky's is a masterpiece. But Soderbergh kept that premise of unknowable alien in the George Clooney version. And now we have Arrival. And Arrival, as seen through the lens of the director, Denis Villeneuve, if I'm recalling his name correct and pronouncing it correctly, is again the view of, as is the story to a large extent, the unknown alien, the unknowable alien, because they are alien. And the thing that is different here is not that we have to know and understand and learn the alien, but we do need to communicate.
Right.
And throw in that premise with the unknowable, and in each of the three movies that I named, amazing graphics. Now, the graphics don't matter that much in Solaris, except when you get to the shot of the planet, and it's not giving too much away to people who haven't seen it or read it, more importantly, read it, that this is the planet itself, rather the ocean on the planet, is in and of itself sentient. It is a sentient ocean. It is the ocean that is the alien. It is still what he does with the movie, and a very low budget from Moscow Films. He makes these are all visually arresting films. So I see Kubrick and Kubrick's 2001, I do not call it Clark's 2001, it's Kubrick's 2001, Tarkovsky's Solaris, again, not Lem's Solaris, and Lem would be very upset if anybody called it that, and Villanueva's Arrival as a trilogy of films. And I've been told one needs to see Arrival on a large screen to capture the awe that he is trying to create.
Well, I've got a big-ish screen. I won't be maybe as awestruck. Maybe I'll just be
mildly enamored. Well, I'm looking for.
So that's one of the four.
Interesting. It sounds interesting.
Another one, which isn't genre at all, is La La Land.
Mm.
And the reason I want to see that in a theater is because it's truly a Hollywood movie. It's a musical. It's supposed to bring back the idea of dress up, go out, you know, go to dinner and see a Hollywood musical the way they were up until the 1950s, not even the 60s, not even My Fair Lady or anything. This is Singing in the Rain type material.
We'll see. I love musicals. Singing in the Rain specifically is perhaps my all-time favorite musical.
Yeah, you and I get into happy arguments about Singing in the Rain versus The Bandwagon, but go on.
Yes, but I'm still a bigger fan. It's more urban. It's more my terrain. But
it's got a better plot line. But yes, both of them have Sid Charisse. But move on.
Yeah. But so La La Land, you know, I first encountered references in the Times, did a piece on it, and everyone is raving. I don't know what it is about me that makes me resist anything everyone tells me I should love. Which
I'm the same way.
Makes it absolutely amazing that I actually stay with the Catholic Church as long as I did. But eventually I did leave. So actually I guess that matches with everything else. But I still cannot sit.
By the way, happy solstice mentioning that. But go on.
Yes, yes. I'll be burning a tree before the week is out. Darkest day, longest, darkest night. We must burn trees, drink liquor, and sex ourselves up to get through and bring the sun back. But at any rate, I still can't sit through Field of Dreams, more than 10 minutes of it. It just pisses me off. And all these things, God, Dances with the Wolves. I my eyes would roll into my head every time I tried to watch that. So I've started to feel a little like that with La La Land. And I do love musicals. I especially love people in contemporary street dress in public simply going into a musical number. There's
move your mic a little. You're popping your peas.
That a street just transforming into a musical number, everybody just getting involved in it. That sucks me in every time. I should really watch the In the Heights, the video they made of In the Heights, because that's what that is essentially. So at any rate, there was already starting to get a little more praise than I felt comfortable with, because at the point people start saying something is that good, I start suspecting it really sucks, and I'm once again falling into the trap of other people's bad taste. So I like Ryan Gosling. I like
Emma Stone.
I think she's delightful. I like the idea, and I love John Legend. I think he's darling. You know, I think they're all. It's a lovely cast. And then I see John Legend on The Daily Show, and he's talking about his role, and he's saying he's sort of the bad guy. He's sort of the heavy, because in the movie, Ryan Gosling's character is like this white jazz musician who's in love with the medium and trying to stay true to it. And John Legend's character is trying to lure him into doing commercial work for money, basically to sell out. I try hard, very, very hard, not to be one of those knee jerk minority people who like go, what? God damn it. You know, they're doing it again. But a part of me is like, I'll see it. I'll give it a fair shot. But a part of me is like, seriously, the white guy is the savior of jazz. It's like I right away I felt my shoulders cringing up. So we'll see. It may not be that is actually how the plot plays out. You know, but it was a little like.
I'm sure it isn't because.
I'm hoping that they don't.
If you take the racial aspect out of it, it's that plot line is the basic musical, Hollywood musical, backstage type thing plot line, including The Bandwagon. You know,
yes,
will she give up ballet to do Broadway?
Yes, yes, no, no. And, you know, we've had innumerable ballerinas being lured to contemporary street dance by attractive young men from, you know, both black and white in countless films as well.
Exactly. And you've always got to have a bad guy. And they wanted to make it multicultural, so they cast a black person.
Yes,
although I agree with you, the problem.
God forbid John Legend should be the lead.
And God forbid also, by the way, that it is a white person who saves jazz. I agree with you on that.
That I had, and again, I will see it. I actually,
But neither of us have seen this film, so it's unfair.
No, no, no. So that's what I'm saying. I'm open-minded. I'm going to watch it. I started. It was a little chink in the armor of its goodness to me. It was like, oh, it's not going to be one of those, is it? And we'll see. It may not be. But,
okay, so that's two of my four.
So what are the other two?
Oh, now I'm forgetting. The fifth movie you and I have already seen. We'll discuss that in a few minutes. Yeah. But what are the other two? Oh yes, I still have not seen the new It Isn't a Harry Potter film.
Oh yeah,
which is a Harry Potter film.
Well, that one got a little flack for having a whole Harlem scene with no black people in it, evidently. But I think there's one, maybe, you know, who's sort of peripherally black or something. But
yeah, they did that in The Hulk as well.
Well, you know, okay. When we get to the fifth movie, I'm going to bring that topic up again in a different context. So
yes,
we'll
very good. I very much enjoyed the Potter films. I thought that she did a lot of brilliant world building, or rather, she built a world from worlds that other people had already built.
Yeah.
And I think that she did probably she being J.K. Rowling, of course, did the best synthesis of other people's work that ever I have seen. The writing
is a gift.
The writing style of the first few books, at the very least, is pure Agatha Christie.
I don't know Christie's work well enough to know that.
Yeah,
I only read the first three and the last one. Part of me was like, yeah, Voldemort, I get it. They're chasing down Voldemort. Let me just skip to the end. So I will admit, I have seen all the movies. Because it's much easier to watch the movies than read the 3-inch books, but you know, and I love reading books. It's not that I didn't want to read the books, but I just sort of got the point at a certain point, and I didn't need to
And also, they're not necessarily for your or my generation.
No, not at all.
That if you take your typical Agatha Christie story, by the time you've read your 40th on your way to your 70th Agatha Christie novel, you know exactly what the kinds of things. There will be a person who is in fact different, related to somebody else, and it is different from the person that you thought they were.
They murdered everyone.
And that will be key to the mystery of the story. And that's certainly true in at least the first three Harry Potter books. And those are carried forward into the movies as well. And it's also the denouement, the way they are structured. It's you can write a flow chart of how Agatha Christie works, and you will see that it works in Rowling. Then you take the wizard school, and it's Le Guin.
Mm-hmm.
Not the whole thing, but just the very premise of here's a school for wizards. And at least with the first book of the Potter books, it is the first two books of Earth. Help me.
I don't know the books as well as you. But I would also say she also folded in a bit of Roald Dahl and let's murder his parents and throw him in a closet. You know, yeah, no, she drew on things very well. She drew on the body of British work in various genres and made a very good piece of work that's made her so comfortable.
So the thing about Fantastic Beasts, and again, folks, there's a spoiler here. There's a big, big spoiler that I will not give, and I haven't seen the movie. But I'm aware of it nonetheless because it's hard to avoid. And the spoiler is that, guess what? It's almost a way to get people to want to watch all the Harry Potter films over again because it's such a tie-in. There are so
it's the Rogue One of the Harry Potter series.
Even more. Yes, it's a bona fide prequel, but Rogue One is a standalone film, and this is the first of five.
They keep saying that, though it evidently ends pretty much where four begins or something from the sound of it.
Yeah, yeah, like, from what I understand,
it's a standalone. It's really, we don't have
yeah,
to see
it's really not a standalone, is it?
Made
but it's a one shot, okay? The other films have already been made. In this case, there are going to be five films in this series, which will not all be, very clearly, will not all be Prime about the Eddie Redmayne character.
Mm. Well, it's a universe, and they're just going to explore it much like this world.
More, it's more
a
of a
franchise.
Closed...
It's not a universe. It's a franchise.
It's a franchise.
A nice little hot dog stand that they can open infinitely.
But like Rogue One.
Decor, like the Fry's stores in California.
But like
each
Rogue
One. Of
one
the shops can have a different theme.
Like yes. Rogue One, it is less of a standalone than people think.
Yes, exactly.
It is very, very, if you don't really know your Potter, you can think of it as the first of the prequel films.
As a primer. Well,
no, it's not a primer. It's another thing altogether.
But it's still the it's
and
still,
I can't discuss it more.
It's still the welcome mat to the House of Harry Potter. And I don't think that's a problem. I think that's perfectly delightful. I'm going to see it. I mean, I love I love fantasy to that degree. I like magical crap.
It's know, actually like, not to the House of Potter, but to the House of Hogwarts.
Okay.
If you know the end.
I'm just saying either way, it's the same universe. Whether it's Hogwarts or Harry, it's the same universe. It's the welcome mat to that book franchise. And I'm just saying, you start getting like really specific about the wording, it's that world that she's opening the door to with this movie. And it's also the fact that you can like find other things to do in it. I mean, there'll be post Harry Potter. We'll get the Potter kids.
There already
point.
Is post Harry
already
Potter.
Done the
yeah.
stage play. They'll be doing the musicals and the movie soon, but whatever. No, it's interesting. So what's the fourth movie?
Yeah, that's a good question now. Now I'm trying to remember. It's like I have
is
to.
It, we can make a game show. It's like, well, what is it? Is it genre? We can do.
It is genre.
Okay. Is it science fiction? It would
yes.
be a horror.
Well, it's science fiction or fantasy.
You don't really like Deadpool because you don't like blood and gore anyway. So, but it's genre. It's not the fifth movie because we know what that is. It's not Passengers because you didn't even want to talk about that. Is there a female lead or a male lead?
I don't recall. If I could recall, I could answer your questions.
But you can't think of anything about it.
Look, yeah, if I could look at a list of the movies that are currently running, which I suppose I can if I open a browser. Okay,
let's see. Current.
All you have to do is go to Google and type in movies, colon, and you'll get all the movies. It's okay. Not Sing. It's not Assassin's Creed.
Why is it just telling me old ones? I said sci-fi movies.
I'm looking at what's playing. I've already seen Doctor Strange, which I enjoyed a great deal.
Which I want to see before it leaves theaters. So I have to see it this week before the Christmas movies shove it all out.
Now you see that's
they'd be gone already.
That's funny that you that there are some films that you're saying, oh, I don't care if I see that in the theater, but Doctor Strange,
3D, bitch.
You know what? It doesn't matter.
Giant 3D. Oh, they said it did. I want good 3D.
There are, I would say, about every time they do the Inception bit, folding things. Then
yeah, I was watching a few minutes of that the other day and wondered how I got through that the first time.
It's not a very good movie. And pardon me.
It's not Rogue One.
Well, maybe it is Rogue One. Maybe that is my fourth film.
That might be the fourth one.
And
you haven't seen that. Yeah,
I didn't mention it yet. Okay. So the film that I have seen, and I will simply say that Doctor Strange, okay, as a lad, I would tune in a particular radio station called WBAI. And one of the things they had on BAI in the late 60s, early 70s were PYP, Programs for Young People, and they had an ongoing serial of Doctor Strange, Master of the Mystic Arts. And I was not a Marvel comic fan. I read more of the DC comics as a lad. But because of that WBAI serial, I started reading, and by the way, collecting, and still have, the 1960s issues, the Steve Ditko issues of Doctor Strange. And I have to say that the movie lives up to my mind's eye of the radio series and my physical eye of the original, not the later when Doctor Strange practically becomes a member of the Avengers and stuff, which no doubt will happen.
Or the Defenders, more like, because
that, no.
Team he joined up in.
Well, actually, that would make sense because Doctor Strange is a Hulk, New Yorker. But we know that Doctor Strange is a major character in the next Thor movie. So there's
that would lead us to the Defenders because that was two of the five members of the Defenders.
Oh, was the Hulk a member of the Defenders?
It was Strange. It was Hulk. It was I've been reading these comics. Namor.
I'm planning any Namor films. I liked those, I have to
they
say.
They sort of stick him in dark. A cameo shot in something, didn't they? No. I'm thinking of DC Aquaman. They did a weird Aquaman. But no, Namor basically is an arrogant muscle boy in a bathing suit who keeps hitting on Sue Storm. There's not, I don't know how much they can do with it.
Okay, so the last movie, since we only have 10 minutes left.
Yes.
Oh, that we've both...
You've kept me on the whole show, you bum. Okay.
Yeah, that we've...
Okay, but go on, yes.
Yeah, I kept you out. You were going on and on and on about Passengers. At any rate, the Miss Peregrine's School for Peculiar Children. And I have to say, I just, and when I say just, I mean 2 days ago, my soporific was reading the trilogy by Ransom Riggs. I saw the movie a while ago. In fact, during Capclave, we saw it in Washington, D.C., at a charming theater, by the way. And I enjoyed the movie. It's like, you know, I enjoyed it more than I've enjoyed any Tim Burton film in a number of years. Having said that, it doesn't have the entire feel of a Tim Burton movie, but which is a good thing.
Well, I don't know. It's slightly more benign. I tend to like him on his darker sides, but he hasn't been dark in a while.
Well, that's
Dark Shadows was really a family, you know, warm family drama.
Yes, well, but his version of Planet of the Apes, you know, who cares?
Yeah, don't mention that movie.
Well, exactly. There's my point.
I walked out of Planet of the Apes. Planet of the Apes was Tim Burton. I'd forgotten that.
Yes, it was absolutely Tim Burton.
I walked out with my friend, another friend of his, and his daughter, who was like 9 at the time. And she walked out of the theater. She said, "That movie really sucked, didn't it, Daddy?" And we were like, "Yes, yes, Hannah, it really did. You're a wise child." I had forgotten it was Burton.
Actually. Yeah, no, I mean, I'm a huge fan of Edward Scissorhands and the original Batman films.
I haven't seen Big Eyes yet, and I'm curious about that.
I'm curious about it, but it's not...
I'm curious, but it's going to be, it'll be interesting to look at, I think.
Nightmare Before Christmas is one of my favorite films, Beetlejuice and all that. But in recent years, just looking at IMDb, his Alice film...
Don't. I can't bring myself to watch the second, the first one I hated so much.
As a producer, Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter...
Wait, that was Burton?
As producer.
Oh, interesting. Weird. I didn't know he had his hands on that.
Now, I did like Mars Attacks.
Okay, but we have little time. Let's get back to Peregrine.
Okay, Peregrine.
One of the things...
But let me say one thing. Yeah. I loved and adored the book Tales of the Peculiar, which are short stories that take place within the Peculiar universe, although none of the characters in the Miss Peregrine movie. And the movie, the first two-thirds, and I'm just going to talk from the viewpoint of somebody who's read the book, the first two-thirds of the movie is identical, captures the feel and the, shall we say, peculiarity and the fun of the Ransom Riggs novel. And then it basically goes off into this carnival land where they're all running into the time loops and things like that. And it wraps it all up, and fans of the book, which I had not seen the book beforehand, fans of the book were upset that it did not follow the book. And when I read the book, I thought, it's a good thing they didn't follow the book, because the book is not only a cliffhanger, but the trilogy is in fact one story. It's really one book in three volumes. And there's no easy way to break it up. And in fact, I thought those three volumes would have been much better off taking the last two books and compressing them into one slightly longer book from the beginning. And that would have been good. But and in a way, I think that's what Tim Burton did with the film. And as a film versus a movie, and I thought that the adaptation was a righteous one. There are a lot of problems with the logic of the film, and that's, I know, where you want to come in.
Well, no. I was going to go back to the issue earlier of race in films and multiculturalism.
Yeah, please.
I read something complaining that Miss Peregrine was so white, and it's like, I don't know how it could have been anything else. It's a very white story. It's not, you know, they're set in England in 1943. Working black faces or Asian or whatever into that would have been awkward and a little odd. And I think there are times when it's all right to have a movie about white people, for white people, or for black people. I mean, it doesn't matter. I think that there are times when we need to lighten up perhaps a bit.
It's actually a modern film that visits 1943.
Yeah, and I dislike it when multiculturalism is wedged into a movie simply
for the sake of
reasons.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought Morgan Freeman in Robin Hood was really pushing it. It's like, what? We had to get a black guy, so he's this Muslim. I mean, it kind of had a logic, but as soon as Kevin Costner opened his mouth, any logic went out the window. So it had charming aspects. I always love what's her name, who's terrible, and I can't think of her name.
Eva Green?
Yes, I like her. She's such an odd little actress, and she was quite lovely in this. I mean, she had she did very well.
I liked her ever since Casino Royale.
Yes, I was.
And the movie that everybody hates, but I don't, which is The Golden Compass.
I don't hate it. I'm not enamored of it.
My problem with the film is that it runs about an hour to an hour and a half too short.
Yeah, probably in part. But also, we won't get into that.
Okay.
But with Miss Peregrine, basically, I thought it was nice. I didn't quite, I don't know if I missed something. I wasn't quite grasping the concept that you're going to live your life as a child with a nanny in a loop that repeated the same day over and over again infinitely. If it was because if they ever left, they would be eaten by the bad guys. I guess it made sense in that there was a time when they did not live that way till the massive bad experiment that created the antagonists. But it was very odd. You pointed out that it's a little peculiar that the 16-year-old boy is having a romance with this young woman who's actually 104 or something.
And it's her second romance with him.
I'm thinking it's a little more peculiar that he's taking grandpa's sloppy seconds, which is like really.
Well, that's what I'm pointing out.
Yes. It's like not only is she five times his age, but she pretty much had an affair with his grandfather. And why isn't his father a peculiar? How did this skip a generation?
Oh,
why does dad see things?
Okay.
Or mom?
It is in the books. It is conceivable that any number of people are peculiars, but in fact that Jacob, our lead character, he has only scratched the surface of what's peculiar about him. Peculiars don't necessarily know their peculiarities. Sometimes they see only a small portion of it and they stop there thinking that's it, when in fact that's but the tip of the iceberg.
Many other people
can be peculiars, and it just they never recognize that they are. But well, but there's one far more important aspect.
Yeah.
And this one really gets when you read Ransom Riggs, and especially, particularly, the book Tales of the Peculiar, is, as far as the author is concerned, and this is unfair for a trilogy, but when you read his short stories, you really get it. As far as he's concerned, he's doing nothing more than writing fairy tales. Light, short, don't look at the logic, because there's less logic in this than there is in Charles Perrault or the Brothers Grimm fairy tales.
We could do a whole other show where I would counter that argument that there's a very specific logic in the fairy tales.
I'm not saying that you're not right. I'm telling you what he's doing. My perception of what he's doing.
My perception of what he's doing is lucking into a nice, lovely little franchise that outrages the rest of us who work really hard at it. But more power to him.
No, I mean,
these are the times where he's like, I found these old photos.
It's a delightful.
I can't believe it became a bestseller and I'm suddenly rich. And it's like, you bastard.
I bet if you were to read Tales of the Peculiar, you'd love it.
No, I'm sure. I mean, I was a peculiar. I mean, we all were. And the thing is, here's the thing. I'm a firm believer, and we'll probably end up wrapping on this, that we are all of us vessels. I actually was thinking about writing something called The Vessel, which I have to figure out what it is. But I'm a firm believer that writers are empty vessels. We get filled with things from whatever that muse is that fills us, and we churn things out. He's obviously tapped into something very essential, which is the sense of disconnect that a lot of people of a certain age have that makes us feel peculiar. I felt peculiar as a child. That's why I loved Narnia. I so wanted to go into the attic of my grandmother's house and find a door to anywhere but Queens. You know, it was like, please.
And the Magicians does that very well as well. The Lev Grossman books. Are you still there? Somehow, all of a sudden, we got a digital artifact, and I'm not.
Can you hear me?
Now I can.
Ah, my cord came a little bit loose. I just plugged it back into the light.
Okay, stop talking with your hands. We've got
to move. I'm actually holding the microphone over my belly as I recline on my stool here. But yes, I mean, it's. I think all those things. I mean, I think that alienation. Kids who read tend to spend a lot of time alone because they are somewhat alienated. So writing books about alienated children who spend time alone finding things that the other kids don't is a very good device, because I was one of those, and there are a large number of us out there, and that, I think, is a large reason.
And that's why in so many fairy tales, the protagonists are orphans.
Or the youngest child. Do you know how frustrating it is as the oldest child to constantly be demonized in every fairy tale you read, to constantly have the oldest children be the stupid, annoying ones who screw up everything? I said fluck. There was an L in there.
I heard
it. And the youngest child is always the one who says everything. I used to look at my youngest sister somewhat as
I think that this is a whole other category that I would love to do. And what's more, I'd like to have you and either Dora Goss or Rick Bowes involved in this conversation to really dig into the fairy tale thing.
You've planned a whole other show.
I just did.
Well, I will give it back to you as you need to.
As I need to turn it over to Lister.
I believe. Wish him my best. I didn't see Lister today, but I know he's always.
He's actually quite on time. He's been here for a while.
He's
wandering about.
He's got his records out, so wish him well for me.
I will do that. Thank you.
Indeed.
And people will find you online where? TerrenceTaylor.com?
TerrenceTaylor.com.
And you
believe in vampires.com.
And you will be attending the next NYRSF reading on January 10th.
Indeed. It's such a luxury to be able to attend it as a spectator, not as the prime technician.
Well, in this case, I do consult.
You will be
consulting, because I can run the cameras. What I have not learned are putting up the graphics.
You'll learn that this coming month.
Indeed. Indeed, I shall. Yes. Okay, thank you.
Indeed, and thank you all
okay.
for listening.
And we, go out with our alternate theme music.
Ah.
Okay, which is appropriate to the season. And as we do so, Terrence, I didn't mean to get quite so abrupt. Something else happened there as I was double-clicking the song. Ah, there it is. There we go, and it's now at a level at which I can voice over. But this is, of course, Jethro Tull with Ring Out Solstice Bells. Next week, very possibly, but not necessarily, the Council of Elrond. And, well, it's an annual thing on this show, although it hasn't always been. If you have a reason that you think I oughtn't do the Council of Elrond, write me, because I have to go to a lot of trouble to do that, since it runs over 90 minutes, and the show's only 90 minutes long. So you can write me, jim@ourwolf.com, H-O-U-R-W-O-L-F, or join the Hour of the Wolf book on Face group. And in the meantime, good solstice to everybody. Please treat everybody well, because not because of the time of year, because they're people, we're people, and you should do that in general. Have a wonderful time, and we will talk next week. Good morning, and stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lister, coming your way over these same airwaves. Out these bells, ring out, ring solstice bells, ring solstice bells. Ring out those solstice bells. To the distance is the sun. Joyful as the silver planets run. Seven maids move in seven time. Sing the sound of bells, call out the chime. Ring out these bells. Ring. And sorry for that bit of noise, but speaking of noise, this is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. And, oh, yes, by the way, Lister, let me switch another computer for you, because I was using the other one. Here you go. So now you're set up for your theme. We'll be right back.
trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's off the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system works to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pigs work. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my right in this writing. The Constitution, yo, that's an illusion. Huh, suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too.
Cinco List Live, WBAI 99 Cinco. List Alive. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Pablo Moses.
Pave the way, Rasta. Pave the way. Pave the way, Rasta. Pave the way. Say
the wind.